All right. Well, this is going to be freaking fantastic. I'm just telling you. Like, my boy Tommy Rinaldi, been friends with a long time, actually sent me a picture of Tessa, his daughter, the other day with my daughter, and they were like T90. And now Tessa's about to, she's looking at schools, and she just, you know, visited the University of Georgia, but he's got a great family. His wife is way cooler than him, Diane. She's a war daddy, physical fitness freak. Jack is a stud who's going to Notre Dame. So awesome family. But Tommy Rinaldi, the best storyteller in the business. And this will be story time for an hour. So we'll make this two-part because Tom can talk. I mean, I'm just telling you right now, my boy can blow. But his stories are phenomenal. So welcome to the pod, Mr. Rinaldi.
Oh, thank you for that incredible introduction, DP. Brent, great to be with you too. I'm going to start just right away with a very quick table setter. And that is a one piece, one little anecdote that I use to describe David Pollack that did not air on television, did not feature him splitting his pants, doing a 50-inch box jump on live TV. We were at Baylor, and after a production meeting with game day on a Friday, I want to say it was after, sometimes DP would go and work out, and I have no idea what weights, David, you held in your hand. All I know is you did lunges the entire length of a football field, then turned around and did them back. I would ask anyone who listens to this, if you want to challenge yourself without any weights in your hands, without holding dumbbells, try to do lunges the length of a football field one way. He went up and back while holding dumbbells in both hands. Again, I don't know what the weight was. Freak show.
Yeah. Well, when you sit on the toilet the next day and it hurts, it's a
there's the indicator. There you go. There's the indicator.
There's 100% reason why. But we got to work together for so long, Tom, and obviously you've moved on and done different things now too with Fox, and so cool, part of the Super Bowl, and just cool to watch your career continue to grow. But like, the storytelling is what everybody thinks about, I think, especially in my world. And everybody always says that he's going to make you cry. But there are so many things to get into with you. But like, first, you know, I'm going to let you do it, actually. What's the story that's the most captivating that people all the time stop you or say something? Or what's the story that you remember the most over all these years? Because you've done so daggum many.
I'm just going to give you the cheating answer, and it won't satisfy you, David. But fortunately, we're not in close proximity, so you can't reach over and beat me, because you would. And that's, of course, the next one, right? You're always hoping that the next story that you get the chance to tell. And the truth is, and you know this, David, that when you make a comment, when you tell a story, when you put something out in the world, you really don't know how it's going to be received. You don't know how people will react to it, what resonates and what doesn't. I do know this, that it took me a long time to discover sort of the three central themes in story that resonate with me the most. And I do many, many stories that don't touch on these themes at all. But the three that do, years and years into my career, I was able to identify. And they are the line between living and dying, greatness, its pursuit and its cost, and forgiveness. To me, those three themes are so rich. They're so deep. They're so compelling in what they can describe through our journeys. And many of those, many stories actually have more than one of those themes contained within them. So whether it be the man in the red bandana, David, you know, the story
so I know, good.
You
know Boston about, College, about
9/11,
oh, yeah.
Whether it be Tyler Trent, the Purdue fan who improbably and incredibly predicted that Purdue would beat Ohio State when they had no business doing so, as he was, you know, in the fight of his life against cancer. Well, and again, we could go on and on with so many of the different stories that we've had the chance to tell and are continuing to tell now with the Big Noon Kickoff at Fox, and we had the chance to do on game day. It's just it's an amazing honor and privilege to have the country as canvas, especially through the wonderful vehicle.
Okay, football. So that was a bad question. I'm 0 for 1 in questions. Let me ask it a different way. Actually, let me just say this. The Mike Leach story, I find so incredibly amazing. Tell everybody the Mike Leach play sheet story and anything you got on that, because I can't hear that enough.
I know you love this story. Mike Leach, God rest his soul, who was one of the great, great characters in college football, in any sport, really. And I'll just give a very, very short version of the story. But before I do, DP, what interaction did you have with Leach in your life, if any?
Well, we called several of the Thursday night games. So we got to spend plenty of time in his office, Geronimo, Swords, like definitely get to know the personality and the uniqueness and the way he just communicate. It was just fantastic. He was so different in so many ways that made him so awesome.
Well, let me tell a quick story. David referenced our son, Jack, who's at Notre Dame. He's a junior at Notre Dame now. So this goes back nearly two decades. When I would leave home to go and tell these stories and then go on to, at that part of my life, to be on game day with David, sometimes Jack would ask me, most times, Dad, where are you going? What story are you going to tell, et cetera? Jack at this point was just in grade school, maybe in first grade. And I explained to him that I was going to go and talk to a coach named Mike Leach, and that Mike Leach was a really accomplished coach, a unique personality, and that he loved pirates. And I'm getting ready to go, get in the car to go to the airport. And Jack says, wait, Dad, wait. And he goes back into the house and comes out with a plastic plate that he would sometimes use, which had pirates on it, and said to me, give this to the coach. It's got pirates on it. He might like it. Maybe Jack was 5 or 6 years old. We go and we talk to Leach. This is when he's at Texas Tech. Years later, when he's at the Palouse at Washington State, sure enough, we go, we visit. The very first thing Leach says to me, you got to come into the office, Tom. And on display, on the shelves behind his desk, is Jack's plastic plate with the pirate on it. And he's just like, you got to tell him. You got to take a picture. You got to tell him. It's going to continue to make the moves with me. It's going to continue to be a part of my office and everything else. That's as good an indicator of Mike Leach as any. So very quickly, the play sheet story, when Mike Leach was a coordinator before he had become a head coach, without getting bogged down into all the details, he had an idea. And the idea that came to him, like maybe 36 hours before the game, after the game plan had completely been crafted, that what if we created a complete dummy play sheet with completely false plays? And in a false flag operation, we have a football staffer pretend to drop it, accidentally drop this play sheet as the team comes back into the locker room after warmups. Do you think anybody would ever go for that? Could that work? Now, no one else in the room even has time to answer. Before you know it, Leach is up till 4 a.m. and he does it. He creates this completely false, fake play sheet, a fake game plan. And then he enlists a staffer to have it look laminated, have it look like the actual play sheet. Remember this, David? Some guys would wear it hooked, like to the belt. Right? Yep. So he had the staffer hooked to the edge of the belt, and they practice going through making the gesture look legit. Look, you're gonna act like you're just fixing it on the belt loop, and then it's just gonna drop, and you have no idea. And you're just gonna come in, no idea. You just come in with that gravelly voice, like David Yostrel. Sure enough, they drop it. They come back out. It's gone. They dominate the first quarter. I mean, dominate. They score. I don't know. I don't remember, DP, but it's the first four possessions.
They and it's dominate. Against Texas and the Red River rivalry. Versus
Texas.
I mean, he was the offensive coordinator, and every play call was like the opposite of exactly what the play call was, to take advantage of everything possible, and everything clicked, and they absolutely jumped out the gates.
And I think it wasn't until, I don't know, the details have faded in my mind, if it took them, David, until halftime. I have a feeling they corrected themselves and caught themselves and realized, wait a second, we've been duped.
You've been pumped. That we're looking at.
That's Mike Leach, and that's why he's such a treasure in college football. And that's one of a thousand stories. And my colleague, Bruce Feldman, who's amazing, who wrote Leach's book with him and was one of his closest friends, could tell you story after story. He's just an amazing, amazing guy. And like I said, we lost a treasure in the sport when he passed.
Was there some sort of like random conversation about the most obscure thing that you remember having with him?
So one of the things that sort of vaulted Leach into the greater public consciousness when he was at Texas Tech is he would have a radio show, a coach's show. Obviously, coaches still have these shows, not as much on the radio anymore. And who knows where this idea came from? And David, I don't know if you even know this story. A student called in. I don't know. This was early in Leach's tenure to say, Coach, I need some advice. I've been trying to get this girl to go out with me. David,
because
it's such a great story. Coach, she said yes. What should we do on our first date? And that was kind of the beginning of where people would ask Mike Leach these questions that had nothing to do with football, which would yield unforgettable tangential answers. So one of the things that Leach went into right away was, if you take her out to eat, you don't take her for a steak or anything like that with sort of thick beef, because then you're worried. If you have stuff stuck in your teeth the whole time, you're already nervous. Now you're worried about that. He breaks that down. Then he breaks down what, if you go to a movie, you don't really talk. Maybe that's good if you don't have much of a personality, but you don't learn much about her personality. So then there's another quick Leach story. He was critical to the local media in Lubbock about the inability to get an accurate forecast for game days. And one of the local weathermen challenged him to come. If you think it's so easy, coach, come on and do the weather. You please go out of your way and find that clip. Mike Leach in front of, it's a green screen. There's nothing actually there. It's then projected on. The whole weather map is an absolute disaster. It looks like he's having a bit of a convulsion as he's trying to point. He doesn't know where the front is coming in. Yeah, there are endless stories with him. Just a magical guy.
By the way, before I let Brent ask you another question, I already wrote it down, the timestamp, when Tom uses big word number one, tangential or whatever the crap that was.
Tangential,
so we got one word for Rinaldi. So go ahead, Brent.
I mean, I knew what he was talking about, but so you mentioned the next story being the one that you're focused on. Given all these events and games and whatnot that you've covered, what's on Tom Rinaldi's bucket list? Is there something that you haven't seen, haven't been to that you do want to go cover, do, or be a part of?
You mean, Brent, as an event, right?
Story, possibly, but more so event.
Boor event, yeah. So this is the miracle of why I won the lottery with the gig, right? And that I have both sides of the coin. I have the immediacy, the rush, the phenomenal experience of seeing games live. David has the incredible experience of calling games live, which is so much harder than people really understand. And then I get the chance to tell the stories of the journeys of the players and the coaches and the teams. Coming to Fox, I've had the chance to check off two of those in the most amazing way. I really did not cover the NFL. And now I do. I cover it every Sunday on a sideline with Aaron Andrews on the other sideline, on our crew with Kevin Burkhart and now Tom Brady. We just did our second Super Bowl in 3 years, which is amazing. The other one, Brent, is the World Cup. And I was blown away. The first World Cup that I did as part of a broadcaster that has the rights to it in Qatar with Fox, I do think college football prepares you to some degree for the World Cup because yeah. College football is somewhat tribal. It's deeply geographic and in its fandom and in its passion. I mean, and imagine that multiplied, and that's the World Cup. Imagine that there aren't 138 programs in the FBS, but there are just these teams that qualify to play in the true world championship. That's not to say that the World Series isn't real, that you don't win the world championship when you win the NBA title or the Super Bowl isn't a world championship, but it's a completely different thing in that sport to win that event. And you could make a case, whether you're a soccer fan or not, that the last World Cup final, the way it played out, yeah. with Mbappe and Messi, the lead, the fight back, the conclusion, I mean, might be the greatest sporting event ever. It was the most viewed sporting event in the history of the world, and it lived up to every possible expectation.
Jeez, so pump the brakes there, soccer. Come on. Yeah, now.
Okay. I see. Here we go on soccer. I really,
I mean, I love the answer, but here's what's crazy. What people don't understand, like you're talking about World Cup, you're talking about Super Bowl, national championships in college football. Oh, but he's also the same guy that's covered tennis for years and the elite of the elite, like golf, the elite of the elite. So we're definitely getting some stories here when it comes to, like, we're going to start with golf because I think one of the biggest names in this, no, the biggest name in the sport, the creator of the new sport that everybody follows, like you got to go hang out with Tiger Woods and kick it and show him and teach him. You taught him how to hit a driver, didn't you? Like you really showed him, you gave him the framework, right? Like you worked on that with him.
Negative on that. I will say this. Tiger is unique in so many ways, but to give a direct crossover to college football, when Tiger was in his prime, and maybe even to some degree still now, I think, David, I think you'd agree with this. If you went in to talk to Nick Saban, if you went to talk to Stoops, if you went to talk to, at that time, Urban, if you, no matter what coach you went to talk to, there was one guy everybody wanted to hear about. Everybody wanted to hear about Tiger. Everybody wanted some story, insight, some notion about Tiger Woods. I can't describe it. I've never experienced someone that compelling. Like, you know that question we sometimes ask? Who's your favorite player's favorite player? And I think the answer back then, and maybe still, your favorite player's favorite player, there's a good chance it's Tiger Woods. You know, why? Not only dominant, not only the champion, not only changes the sport.
Why?
Yeah, but Thank you, DP. That's an inside joke there. I get mocked on that all the time. I also think it's because he was such an amazing closer. And I think your favorite player, your favorite coach, they're most compelled by that. They're surrounded by talent. They understand all these other things, but closing, clutch. I think that's what people associate with Tiger most. And why wouldn't you?
So what'd you get to do with him? What was your memorable moment with him?
So I'll give you one that I think is really remarkable. We had a chance to tell a story years ago about a young woman who grew up in Nepal, right, named Pratima Sherpa. And again, you can't make it up. It sounds like a Hollywood script. Pratima grew up living in essence, the greenskeeper hut of a golf club in Kathmandu, Nepal. That's where she was raised. That's where the family lived, in the greenskeeper's hut. And her dad, a greenskeeper at one of the only golf clubs in Kathmandu and in the country of Nepal, began to teach his daughter to play. At first, no lie, by getting a limb, carving it into the shape of a club, and teaching her to hit with that. I mean, that already sounds Paul Bunyan-like. That can't be true, but it is. She goes up. She then gets a leftover set of clubs. And you can see where this is going. She becomes an outstanding golfer in a country where very, very few women play. There was a piece that ultimately we did about Pratima. We traveled to Nepal. We shared her story as she vied to essentially earn the right to compete professionally against men in Nepal. She comes up short, but she still competes in such a real and game way. It's inspiring. She loved Tiger. And early, as she was first being noticed in her country, Golf Digest did a piece about her. Tiger saw the piece and wrote a letter to the golf club to be delivered to her. In the greenskeeper's hut, you can't make it up, it was one of the only things displayed. It was put in a frame, this letter from Tiger. We end up doing the story. One of the first people that we hear from, Tiger. Can she come down? Because Pratima came to America when we ended up showing this piece. She appeared on SportsCenter. She, you know, ESPN did a wonderful job of bringing her over. The piece that we did won an Emmy, and it was entered into a film festival in New York, etc. But while she was in America, Tiger arranged to have her come down to Florida for more than an hour. Tiger and Pratima alone, going through her swing, giving her a lesson, like no camera's not really around. No one really knows about it. I mean, you know, Pratima sent me some photos of the two of them together in golf cart and her in her bare feet as they go through learning on the range. There's something to learn about Tiger Woods. That's the Tiger Woods that I know.
The aura, and like you talked about earlier too, with all the athletes, the aura of him is one that just is still, I think, almost mythical in a way to this day. But
I agree, Brett. Like I would at DP, who in football would you compare to him?
Well, I mean, that's a hard question, but like Mahomes is definitely going to be right now at the top of the game. Like Brady was there, but like just the ultimate guy that made every single person, all ships rise, right? Like Tiger took the game to a whole nother level. Tiger took the game where like schmucks like me were like, wait a minute, is golf actually cool? Like Do I actually like playing golf? Like, that's a horrible sport. It's really slow. It's really boring. But wait a minute. That dude looks good in red. He lifts like he's a war daddy. And like you said, he always finds a way to freaking win. So, yeah, I mean, it's like Mahomes, I think, has brought some of that to the table. But again, it's a team sport, man. Like, yeah, to do it at that level is very, very different, obviously. But Brent,
I was thinking Montana. Like, I was thinking Joe Montana in terms of the oar and the clutch, like all that sort of realm. But that's going way further back. All right, so I think we need to let Tom rip on you a little bit, DP, because we've had a couple past ESPN guests that have, you know, talked about some negative things, and maybe Pollock, you kind of, you know, some idiosyncrasies that you got to deal with Davey. So, all right. What's the best Davey story you got, Tom, that where he's either one annoying the utter crap out of you or just, you know, probably just annoying you actually.
Well, I'm sure one of them, if not both of the things I'm going to mention, have been mentioned by everyone who spent any time around David. Okay. So the third time we had dinner, a production dinner with Tom Brady on our crew, I felt uniquely prepared for the experience. Let me explain why. So we go, we're so spoiled. We go out to these amazing dinners, you know, they're at steakhouses and every possible food indulgence is on the table. There is bread with different kinds of butters. Every single fat is flavor definition is on the table. And then there's Tom Brady, who doesn't really eat the bread, doesn't really slice the butter, doesn't really have the French fry, doesn't drink, doesn't have dessert much. I was having like a flashback to this notion as to Brent, I can't really eat what I want because of the silent, terrible, awful, withering judgment of the food purist and clean eater that is at the table. That was a flashback to being around David Pollock. The difference is Tom Brady will make a comment like, I don't care what you eat, Tom. I care what I eat. Go ahead and enjoy it. David Pollock's version of that is, are you really going to have another one of those? Are you really going to eat that? And then of course the look, the tone, the translation of, are you really going to, is why are you a terrible person? Where have you lost your way in life?
That's aggressive.
Why are you so weak? I mean, all these things. Yeah, if it's aggressive, it also rings true. Yeah,
I thought you were going to say that Davey would say, you know, Tom, what you eat in private, you wear in public. That's one he's probably brought to you before.
I mean, in fairness, Tom, we did have a lot of talks about you wanting to get right, nutrition, being healthy, and then we sat down, and it's like every single
whether I wanted to have these conversations or not, I made the fatal error of cracking that door open one time, and it could never be closed again. Yeah. Okay. The second thing, and I'm not going to say anything more about it, and I don't want us to dwell on it. All right. I'm just going to say a word, and I would like us to move on. Okay. Flatulence. Let's move on.
All right. Hey, we'll transition. We'll move on from that. It's not the worst thing in the world, by the way, to be compared to Tom Brady. It's not the worst thing in the world. So it could be worse. All right. So me and you shared a common love for this dude. And I think you know where I'm going because I've seen you. You covered tennis for so many years. And the greatest tennis player of all time, Rafa Nadal. Like the war daddy himself, like my guy. Like, I loved watching him. I would stay up when the majors happened overseas. Like, I'm watching. I'm getting up. I was getting up at 3 a.m. to watch him beat Fed. Like, I just loved everything about him. You got to cover him and some of his idiosyncrasies and traditions. And, like, that dude is different now. Like, I want to hear a little bit about Rafa.
Well, first of all, I don't know. Have you really delved into – let people understand, David, and I love this about you, how much – where does your passion for that sport come from? Because let's face it, that's not obvious when it comes to the DP profile. Brent, I think you'd agree with that. That doesn't necessarily track, and yet you love it. You love it, David.
I was going to say, my only thought there would just be the one-on-one part of it.
Yes.
Okay.
So there's two things about that. The one-on-one thing, there is no one to look over to your shoulder and blame. Like, there is no, this is me and you, and I got to figure this crap out. And your style might be a little bit different. But I also think, like, the evolution of the game getting more and more athletic, like, these guys, they're going for 4 hours, 5 hours, and they are running the whole entire time. So then you got the point where, you know, they're athletic, the one-on-one competition of it, no one to blame. But then I can reach inside your chest and rip your heart out of your chest by just outlasting you and making you hit more shots. And I think, like, with Rafa, the way he started the match, I always loved sprinting. He sprinted to the baseline. I'm like, okay, I love this dude. Like, this, what? And then I got to know the Cincinnati tournaments, Marty Fish and James Blake and John Isner. And those guys, they stayed at my house for the tennis tournament. We played golf. Like, this is when I was with the Bengals, and they would stay at the house. And then I got to meet some of the other guys and Roddick and those guys. And I was like, this is so much harder than I thought. I remember them, Tom, you'll love this. Roddick was like,
hold on, that's amazing that they stayed with you. I didn't know that till right now. And that's a massive event. The event that Dave is talking about is the largest. It basically the largest event. It's a 1,000. The biggest event before a major category, and that was the huge precursor to the U.S. Open. Go ahead.
Well, and the wifey would cook for him. Like, this is before we had kids, so the wifey would cook for him. So it was like a home advantage. Then we played golf. Like, it was kind of fun. Awesome. But I'll never forget. They were like, "You can't return Isner serve." And I'm like, bull crap. Like, you can't tell me you're going to hit something at me and I'm not going to be able to hit it. They're like, it will hit you. The serve will hit you. And I'm like, no, it won't. And I'll never forget. That's when Marty and James Blake and Isner and Roddick and all them, they took turns just humming that thing. And I was like, ooh, I get a racket on it. And I'm talking about out of the tennis courts, like, just home run. And then you go, holy cow, like, this is a difficult flipping sport. So I think that's kind of what started it. But then Rafa, man, I don't know, man. He just took it to another level for me.
Listen, we're so fortunate to be able to cover it through this golden era of the three of those guys, you know, of Rafa and Roger and Novak. And, you know, a lot of people who think that Novak is the greatest player of all time. Roger, the most elegant of all time. And Rafa, maybe not as easily summarized, but to me, and this is why I think, David, he resonates so deeply with you, because I know you place supreme value on effort. And I just think I've never seen an athlete in his sport embody that value more completely than Rafa. And a simple example of that is in a sport where strategically it's accepted that if you're down 5-1 in a set,
tank it, go to the next.
Exactly. Not that he was down that score that often, but if he were, there was never any other gear. He gave maximum effort on every ball of every match. He's also the rarest competitor that I've seen. I genuinely believe, I don't know, David, if you were this way when you competed, you might have been, because you're such a, again, effort means so much to you. I actually think for Rafa, the competition itself was just as great as winning. it meant just as much to him to compete. He enjoyed it as much as he enjoyed winning. I don't know any other athlete about whom I could say that.
And he would say that. Like, I was always blown away. Like, he would just say how much he just, like, I just love this moment. And whether I win or I don't, but just, he just loved competing. And that there is something about that that's, I'll never forget him hitting the ball girl at one of the main events and then running over and like kissing her on the forehead and just like so human. Like, he was such a good person. Like, you could tell, like, respected the game, respected his opponents, respected people around. And I'll never forget talking to Roddick and all those guys. And they were like, he's a freaking baller. Like, he's just a dude. He's a great person all the time and just good to everyone. Like, there's nothing evil in this dude. And I think that made me love him more.
Had a chance to probably do, I mean, I don't even know, certain a couple of dozen minimum sit downs one-on-one with Rafa through my time covering tennis. Every single time, guys, he came in, he shook the hand of every crew member in any setup, shook every single hand as a global, iconic sportsman known around the world, just never moved off that humility and that modesty, but it was dressed. It sort of cloaked this. And I know this is why you love him, DP. It cloaked this ultimate war daddy, ultimate, like, he's the guy that would be willing to lose the 33-shot rally because he knew he'd
body
win
blows.
Yep, he'd win the next 3 points because you just couldn't recover. And I just, he's the ultimate definition of strap in. It's going to be a long one.
And no one could beat Fed. And that dude would just find a way because of that. Like, and that's one of my favorite sayings, Tom, is like in when workout groups and stuff, and Brett will join us occasionally, but he's skipped way more than he's been to in the last couple of years. is like I want to go to deep waters and I want to see if you suckers are going to swim. Like, wow. I want to do some hard things and see if you're going to cut it loose. And that's exactly right. 30 shot rally. You got to play me the next 3 points, bro. You got to play me the next 3 points and you got to win. And he couldn't, but go ahead, Brent.
I was just saying, all fairness, I do have a day job. Like,
listen, why are you getting defensive, Brent? Don't let him lure you into that.
I know. He's just poking. he does a great job of poking. That's for sure. All right. Now, we'll say, tennis, closely related. I was looking and sort of correct me if I'm wrong here. Handball coach at Morris High School is listed in Tom Rinaldi's Wikipedia bio. Talk about that.
Well, I haven't ever looked at my Wikipedia bio. I'm glad that I haven't, but that is accurate. When I got out of college, I was a teacher and I was a coach initially at a private school, an amazing school in Pittsburgh, Shady Side Academy. And then I went to the other end of the spectrum and I taught at a public high school in the South Bronx in New York City. And I coached, you know, the most urban sport there is. Handball, for those people that don't know, this is not the Olympic version where it's team and it's super fast paced and people are passing the ball. This is basically tennis with a hard ball with no racket. Your rackets are your hands. And there have been some legendary players to come out of New York City in this most urban sport. But I coached the boys handball team for a couple of seasons while I was in the Bronx. Yeah, loved it.
I'm guessing you were good, though. I bet you guys were good.
We did win our division one of the years. So it was just a great, great experience to be able to do that. The entire experience at Morris was great for me.
So one of the stories – we sort of getting back to that kind of storytelling element was the one at the Super Bowl and the Besh family, and just an absolutely tragic story and told so well. But like, the biggest thing for me is, how do you, like, I know it's the job and I'm going and I'm doing it, but how do you keep it together yourself, because me just watching, I can't. It was, I'm watching the story and completely and utterly breaking down.
Well, I think a couple of things there, Brent. One is, so this is the story that Brent's referring to, is about Jack and Tiger Besh, and the Besh family story has now been told, and it's great that it's been told across multiple platforms in multiple ways. Tiger Besh was a player at Princeton who was a returner and a receiver, a good player at Princeton, was in the midst of building his finance career in New York City. He came home for the holidays and decided to go to New Orleans with one of his closest friends, Ryan Quigley. They were on Bourbon Street, you know, past 3 a.m. when the terror attack happened, tragically. And Tiger Besh was killed. The story that we focused on, Jack Besh, his brother, who idolized him, went into football, tried to do everything his brother did. Jack is a legitimate draft pick here. He's probably a second day guy. He played, he was the MVP of the Senior Bowl. He started his career at LSU. He then went to TCU. And he is driven now, and more than ever, to carry this dream that he has, not only for himself, but also to honor his brother's spirit. And it, believe me, I would just suggest seeing any of the stories anyone's done about the Besh family, because they're so remarkable as people. And it brings me back something that David and I would talk about when we would do these stories. And Brent, David, who's just got such a great heart and is such a faithful man, would ask me different versions of that. Like, how do you keep your composure? How do you keep it together when you share these stories, when people share what they do with you, with us? I'm perennially amazed at what people bear and what people share. But so often, the strength that people find within themselves, very, very often through their faith, but the strength that people possess, my goodness, if we could tap into that in a unifying way, oh my goodness, it would just change so much about where we are right now and what people share. And I think just as David has shared what he's gone through in his career, what he went through with his injury, there's a reason for that. I think there's an impulse within us to share these things because we feel it can help. We feel it's connective. We feel it's instructive. We feel, even as modest as David is, we feel it can inspire. And most importantly, we feel like it will let someone know you're not alone. There is a path. There is a way forward. Someone else has been here, and this is what they did. And if you wanted a way forward, here's a way forward. Here's an example. And I think the Besh family choosing to share this in unspeakable loss with Tiger dying, this spectacular young man, and now seeing Jack as he enters his NFL career, I think it's their way of trying to honor their faith, spread the legacy of their son, but also to reach out to the other victims of that terror attack and others who suffered loss. And if that isn't proof of the goodness in people, their strength and their giving nature, I don't know what is. That's why we tell these stories.
Yeah. No, that's why you're good at it. That's why you're really good at it. And that's why you do it, because it isn't just trying to find another story to tell a story. You know, being around you all these years, like, you want to honor people when you sit with them. You want to bring out the good things. You want to share the good parts of the story. And that's why you're good at what you do. And that's why everybody watches. And that's why sometimes we cry. And that's why we're on set sometimes on College Game Day. And we're sitting there, Tom's doing a story, and like, it comes back on, and you're real quick, like trying to dry your eyes because of the good stories. And now obviously with Fox, you do the same thing. All right. I'm going to go a little more lighthearted. I'll never forget with you and your buddy, your boy, Nick Saban. My gosh, like you two, you wouldn't leave him alone. Tom was like his blankie. Like he just followed him around, eating oatmeal pies with him and just kicking it. And why would you do that? Why do you lead like that? Like, I mean, just, you know, you spent so much time with Nick and I, it was just, he trusted you obviously because you did such a good job and you're professional what you did, but like, you got to give me some good Saban stuff because you spent so much time with him.
So here's a little why that connection happened, why he was as gracious to me, why some of the other people that I've covered have been gracious to me is honestly a mystery to me. I don't really know why that is, but with Nick, I think I can point back to an experience that we had. I had read that he came from a quote unquote one stoplight town in West Virginia, right?
And I asked 100% him about true. This,
right? It is true. And I asked him about it, and he had a great line. This is off camera. He just said, no, that's not true. We're still waiting for the stoplight, which I thought was a great line and was true. There is no stoplight in Monongah, West Virginia, where he grew up. So I had said to him, Nick, would you be open and the right time, we would do it anytime you could do it. This is just after he's gotten to Bama, to go back to West Virginia. And he said, you know, if it worked on the schedule, you know, if we could work it out, yes, you know, I'd be open to doing it. And then he said, but you know, if you go back there and you say Nick Saban, no one will think you're talking about me. I said, really? He said, yeah, everyone will think you're talking about my father, Big Nick. He said, nobody called me Nick. I said, they didn't? He said, no. Everybody called me by a nickname, Brother. Brother Saban. And sure enough, they end up making a great run. David knows they go to the Rose Bowl. They face Texas between the SEC title game and getting to the championship game. We have this opportunity to go back to West Virginia, but without him. So we have to ask him, are there some friends of yours, your sister Deanie, you know, that we can talk to back in West Virginia? Sure enough, guys, as naturally as I refer to David as DP, Brent, as naturally as he calls me Tom, not a single friend of his calls him Nick. They're just in the middle of going like, you know, man, look at that job brother's doing. I knew when brother got that job, he turned it around. I mean, they're just, it's amazing. It's like, these are the people that really know you, that yeah. come from where you come from. And I think when we did that story, guys, and he, you know, somewhat famously, Nick like never watches anything. He's so much in his own routine and regiment and to a degree bubble.
Oatmeal pies.
Yep. Eating the little Debbies, but he did see that, I believe. And that probably helped. And I can also say that in his own way, Nick, through the times we spent together and the things he shared, just like with Rafa, I would say this, and Tiger, each of them showed like a shocking personal specific kindness to me in things I went through in my life. David did the same. Like David, I was around David when I lost both of my parents 7 years apart, you know, during football seasons on game day. And David was wonderful to me through that. And in different ways, so were these figures that we covered. I mean, the largest display of flowers and the first one that arrived after my mom passed was from Nick Saban. And that
brother Saban.
That obviously, yeah, brother Saban. And obviously that, you know, means a lot. And I've also experienced the blast furnace. I've had an experience. I've gotten too close to the cold face, you know, the whole thing. But, you know, and this also, I think, guys, is one of the is just such a one. Coaches are fascinating. They are fascinating human beings. They are. They're at times the best of us. They're at times the worst of us. They're at times the most confounding of us. They're at times the loudest and most profane of us. They are amazing, amazing subspecies. They are.
So how's that been different now with covering the NFL, like the college versus the NFL dynamic? What's the uniqueness between the two?
That's a great question, Brent. And can I tell you, I think I'm still navigating that and figuring that out. Remember, what a massive difference. A college coach at most successful ones, I don't know what David would say about David, going back to your recruitment to Georgia, was there any degree of charm or charisma or anything that was appealing to you from the head coach that had a little bit of a shape of salesmanship?
That was a little bit of a salesman?
Yeah.
That was appealing? No.
but that was present in your recruitment.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And in the NFL, that is not only not present, I think it's deep. It just has no value. I think an interesting thing, guys, I love Andy Reid and I know Andy Reid a bit. But traditionally, I think, and it's well known throughout the league, and I don't know if this was the case when David was playing, that the hardest training camps that David went through no longer exist. I mean, they've been legislated out by the NFLPA. They've been, science has suggested that they're not smart. They're not, there's many, many, you know, you could say it's the overall softening of the sport, whatever you want to say. The truth is those training camps that David Pollack went through don't exist. But the closest version is the Chiefs. He runs the hardest, most demanding training camp. And yet, I realize he's a great winner, but he's probably the most beloved coach in the NFL by players. That is fascinating. And the dynamics around NFL head coaches are fascinating. And you know, we're so lucky we're in these production meetings, and I'll tell you, I could sit and I guarantee you, David would love. David, have you ever met Shanahan? Kyle?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
Okay. He has said some things in production calls that are just, I'm jotting down notes, but as soon as the calls are over and I look at my notes, I will transfer things. And he's not the only coach, but I think Kyle Shanahan's amazing, that I put in my phone under this long running tab called Advice for Living. Coaches have so many, they have such endless spots of wisdom. You know, how about just Sean McVay? This tiny line, I know it's not his line originally, but it's just so clear and effective, like as a parent. Here's his line. I see better than I hear. That's just such a great line. Show me, don't tell me. Like, I see better than I hear. And him saying that to players and the whole accountability piece, which I know is so important to David. Like, can you hold a room of grown men, many of whom are making multiples more than you make? Can you hold them accountable? And how do you do it? I find that endlessly compelling. I'm never going to understand scheme and tactic and strategy the way that DP will in his sleep. But the human parts of it, the leadership parts of it are phenomenal. And I feel like we get a great view of that in our meetings.
Well, and you always, like you love, you've always loved that part of it too. And it helped you with parenting. I remember you're always, you're looking for stuff for Jack and for Tessa to be a better dad. And I could name drop so many coaches of you just like sitting there texting and you're like, I'm like, what? Why are you texting him? Well, Jack's got something big coming up. I was trying to find some words to say. And I'm like, yeah, that's normal. And I just text to Kelly. Sure. Like just text Nick real quick. Like no big deal. But you know, it's interesting. The NFL, Tom, they don't have to sell themselves, right? Like exactly. They don't have to sell their program because you're drafted and you're paid. But now with college, they're starting to pay these kids and you do have to sell yourself, or you don't have to sell yourself as much anymore. So obviously, you know, the landscape's changed. Has that changed the way you've done pieces on these guys, or does that change your framework at all with the way you're looking at things?
So listen, we had a chance, and I know this will get heavier than I mean it to be. I'll mention two quick pieces. And listen, you go back 5 years ago, you go back pre-COVID to now, it is almost impossible to characterize the degree of change in college football. We know that, but as we live it, yeah, but as we live it moment to moment, right, we understand that this change was inevitable, right? That I'm not saying every aspect of it, and I'm saying trying to legislate it now, put guardrails around it, give it some genuine shape. There is such a need for it that everyone acknowledges, but how it's done, that's the grand question. Okay. That having said that, we did a piece this year at USC. Being a player is a full-time job. It was when David played, let alone now, let alone getting paid, let alone being repped. Okay. You have very little time to yourself. USC is a program where they take athletes, and you have to be vetted, you have to apply for this, to Eastern Europe to go to Auschwitz to see the concentration camp's remnants. Three football players did that from USC. I mean, guys that don't get a lot of time off, guys that, by the way, are going to play in the league, guys that do not come from Jewish heritage, guys that don't come from Eastern European background, who chose to do that because they felt they needed to learn more. That's one. Two, Northwestern, we did a piece on a walk-on this year, Albert Kunikis, who has a couple of seasons left, 6'3", 220, has some, you know, strong guy, has some twitch, does not have anything below the elbow on one arm, running back. Can't make it up. Got into a game, got a carry, made a bunch of tackles on special teams this year. Like, there's so many unbelievable great stories in the sport. There, even with all the changes, even with the entitlement that comes with NIL, even with all of that. And I think on the NFL side, there's no question. I mean, they don't make them like David. I don't think they ever made them like David, even when David was playing. But it is every one of these guys in the front offices, all the assistant coaches will tell you, it's never been harder. Never been harder to coach the guys.
Just so looking at college football, all the changes that you just mentioned, what did you think just sort of sitting back, maybe even as just a fan of the game, of the 12-team playoff, of how things went? What's your thoughts on how it went and then kind of what it should be or shouldn't be, or just as good as it is?
I think everyone should take a breath and say, celebrate the fact that it happened, understand that it was imperfect, learn from it, and make changes that make it better. I mean, isn't that what, I don't think that's radical. I think no. That sounds pretty simple. And I don't think that the changes are like, I think they're hiding in plain sight. I think people saw the seating was broken, right? That didn't make a lot of sense. I think you can't promise. Listen, with conference realignment, with all those things that happen, conference titles are that's its own fascination right now about what's going to become of conference titles and what those mean, what those games mean, et cetera. But I could tell you this, and I'm going to be biased now, Jack going to Notre Dame, Jack working for Football Ops, Jack working for Fighting Irish Media. So, you know, having a little bit of an experience within the building, which is amazing. Marcus Freeman is amazing. What that gave to that university, to the students, to the student body, to have a game, a playoff game at home, like that is incredible, let alone to ultimately make it to the title game, show lose, I get it, but show fight toward the end. At the end, here's what's amazing. The games are still so often so great. Even though so much around them is a train wreck, the games, I don't know if David feels the same. The games are so good so often. They're really compelling.
Well, and the love, just it's generational. It's grandparents and grandsons, and it's just so much to it. But all right, I got to let you get out of here. But anything else that we haven't covered in your 673 years of covering sports and being on television, because you ain't getting any younger, but anything else stick out, a quote, anything else that you can leave us with, like in the Tom Rinaldi style that you seemed accustomed to doing?
Two Super Bowls ago, final anecdote, two Super Bowls ago, we're in a production meeting. I have the Eagles sideline, right? Obviously the Eagles won this past Super Bowl 2 years ago in a great, great game. They lost 38-35. We're in the production meeting. We're getting ready to wrap the meeting. I ask Sirianni, Nick, if there is a moment where you would be able to reflect upon the journey to get here, when do you think that might be? Sirianni says, Sirianni says, you know, I have this thing I do either at the start of training camp or just prior to it, where I take out my phone and I look at Whitney Houston's national anthem. I watch it, not only because it's the greatest national anthem I've ever heard, but it helps me to visualize what it would be to stand on the sideline before the Super Bowl, to know that's the goal. And when I hear her sing the national anthem, it helps make that goal real. So if there's a moment, it might be during the national anthem. 2 years ago, Chris Stapleton, maybe the only thing other than ice cream that America can agree on, Chris Stapleton and ice cream, sings the national.
I don't agree on the ice cream, but okay, continue.
Oh my God. Please go back. If you've hung with us through this whole thing, go back to the Brady anecdote and just do this at the screen. Okay. lead my life. Okay. Feel my pain. Stapleton does an amazing, amazing national anthem. And sure enough, Brent was making the gesture even before I get to the story. I talked to the best director in America, Rich Russo, and he's ready. And he has the camera right on Sirianni tight as tears come streaming down his cheeks. If you can't be inspired or moved or touched by how magical sport is, then I don't have anything for you. It's the last great campfire in the country. It is such an awesome privilege to cover it. It's flawed. It's got issues. It's got no question. But man, it seems to just have this magic that refuses to be snuffed out.
Well, and that's what Tom Rinaldi has. And that's
why he's the absolute best. And I'm sitting here in awe. Like
I told you, Brent, what was about to go down. Like, this would be story time, a TED talk. Like, you want to jump up and punch somebody in the throat and motivate yourself and change your life. Like, everything about it, man. I've missed working with you. Congratulations, man, on all your success. And keep doing you, because we all love to watch, to listen, to learn. So appreciate your time, my friend.
DP, before I go, we've talked at different times in our friendship together about callings and what it is to be called. And you are called. You are called to help and inspire and lift and pour into people the way you do your son and your daughter, the way you do with people in your faith community, the way you do to the people that come to the gym with you, the way you do to help people through their journeys with nutrition and fitness. But you're called to do that. And you have done that for me, and I'm grateful to you for that.
I think we'll stop there.
I think you're going to make him cry.
No, I mean that.
Hey, that's what we should go. You're not going to make me cry. No, I'm not going to do it again. I'm not going to do it on set.
I'm about to.
Again. Yeah, you're the best, dog. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for – I know that was a lot of your time, but we appreciate you, big dog.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, DP. Thank you, Brent. Great to see you guys. Thank you for having me.